All right, this is November 24th, part one of lecture 25, Historical Assessment of the Vietnam War. It's a fairly important lecture, I guess. I made a mistake of scheduling it on Thanksgiving week, I guess. As originally prepared, this was in three parts of 2 hours each. So I don't have that much time, so I've tried to condense it without leaving anything out that's vital and without making it sound like I'm reading a telegram. Assessment of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was the greatest failure, or defeat, if you will, ever inflicted on this republic. And as Keats has observed, there is no greater hell than the failure of a great object. I see Vietnam War as a failure, not a defeat. We, the Americans, South Vietnamese, and others, failed to solve the problem of Vietnam to the best interests of all. This, I would say, also applies to Hanoi. We had the power, the sheer destructive power, God knows, at our command to do almost anything, but we declined to use such force. In doing so, perhaps we won honor's second prize. Montaigne has said there are some defeats more triumphant than victories, but to most Americans this sounds like a loser's rationalization. I prefer Kipling's remark about some lost cause in India. I don't remember what it was, but he said, we had 40 million reasons for failure, but not one excuse. Vietnamese have a problem that defeat isn't bitter if you don't swallow it. Who then is responsible or to blame for the Vietnam War outcome? Vietnam has a victory, as Napoleon said, has 1,000 fathers, defeat is an orphan. The late fascist Count Ciano in Italy, and the man who should know, said late at the end of World War II, after Italy had surrendered, victory has 100 memories, but defeat has an amnesia. I think that was the fate in the United States. There was a kind of amnesia that developed at the end of the war. It's still there to some extent, but it's largely evaporated. We did embrace amnesia, in effect. It's what I was using and others, and was known as the gone with the wind syndrome. We simply didn't want to think about the Vietnam War. I mean, this is at the White House, it's in the State Department, the Pentagon particularly, military academies particularly. There's this scene in Gone with the Wind when Scarlett O'Hara is sitting in Tara, the old mansion, after the war, and the retainers are still there, come to her and say that we've got these problems, the plumbing doesn't work and the roof leaks, and she has this famous line, I won't think about that today, I'll think about that tomorrow. That's amnesia. And I felt from Henry Kissinger on down, this is the reaction of the leaders who are still there after the war. Not that they don't want to think about Vietnam, they don't want to think about it right now. I'll think about it later. I think I heard you say Henry Kissinger would thought would duck into the woman's toilet if he saw me coming down the hall. I sort of represented the ghost of Christmas past. I was the guy that had to come in and say, we've got this problem of North Vietnam or Vietnam shipping arms to Central America. And what are we going to do about it? And he had to force stop to think about this. Well, that's largely evaporated, I think. Speaking of those of us who went to Vietnam, most of the 3 million, I would say that we went with high motives, with the best of intentions, and by and large, most of us remain loyal to these ideals. Where we differ after the war, even now, is in degree of bitterness. Some awfully bitter people out there. I'm not one of them, but I run into them quite frequently. But in Vietnam's defeat, I don't think it can be said that each of us individually was defeated, or any of us was individually defeated. Or that we really failed in any real sense individually. Because I believe that ultimately in life there's only one real failure possible, and that's not being true to the best that is in you. Let me begin with some general observations. Vietnam and its war defied simplification, did then, does now. At its vortex, Saigon, complexity was the greatest and the views most individualistic. Everyone had their own view of Vietnam, and there was no consensus to amount to much. When I left wartime Vietnam for the last time, I did not leave with any GTC, as we called them, great truths concluded. I didn't know that the war was near, the end was near at the time. It was only 90 days away. I didn't know that. I didn't even suspect it, really. As the moment of takeoff, as the plane roared down the runway, and I looked out first at this huge array of air power in the revetments along the runway, then instantly over the city, and then within minutes over the always green countryside, I had the same thoughts and musings that I have had at 100 different takeoffs, 100 different trips out of Vietnam. Since the last takeoff, I had had no increment in wisdom. I had managed to maintain, perhaps, a cool, objective view, suspecting all the time that objectivity may not reflect sagacity, only uncertainty. That I was leaving behind a place of pluses and minuses, goods and bads, paradoxes and imponderables, leaving with a tinge of sadness that comes in moments of reflection, like that at the plight of the Vietnamese people, at one's own sins of omission, and on the passage of time. As you get older, that's the thing that's the saddest, passage of time. But beyond a clutch of facts about Vietnam that I cart around like an attaché case, all else hangs in the smog of relativity. One concludes that to leave heartened or sympathetic or revengeful or full of despair depends only slightly on where you were or for how long or what you experienced in Vietnam. Only indicates the mental baggage that you brought in with you. There's a passage from Carl Sandburg's book, The People, Yes. Arguably, I would say, the greatest book ever written by an American. It's a book-long poem, is what it is, in blank verse. Who was that early sodbuster in Kansas? He leaned at the gatepost, studied the horizon, figured what corn might do next year, tried to calculate why God ever made the grasshopper, why there was such a spread between what he got for grain and the price quoted in Chicago and New York. Drove up a newcomer in a covered wagon. What kind of folks live around here? Well, stranger, what kind of folks was there in the country you came from? Well, mostly there were a bunch of low-down, lying, thieving, gossiping, backbiting, not of people. Well, I guess, stranger, that's about the kind of folk you find around here. And the dusty gray stranger had just about blended into the dusty gray cottonwoods in a clump on the horizon when another newcomer drove up. What kind of folks live around here? Well, stranger, what kind of folks was there in the country you come from? Mostly they were mostly a decent, hardworking, law-abiding, friendly lot of people. Well, I guess, stranger, that's about the kind of folks you find around here. And the second wagon moved off and blended with the dusty gray cottonwoods on the horizon, while the early sodbuster leaned on his gatepost and tried to figure out why 2 days of hot wind can smother the life out of a nice stand of wheat. Carl Sanford, the people, yes. A raw opinion on Vietnam and its war are cheap and largely worthless. Even straight facts are of limited value. Of course, to understand Vietnam, it is necessary to collect data, but the fumbling comes in isolating the important fact from the welter of trivia, and distilling the data from meaning, and not being seduced by the trivial. The materials consist of past and present events, our opinions of them, the ideal of what might be. The task of those of us who write or teach about Vietnam is to relate the reality of the war to the logic of our experience. Herein lies the gulf. And that is why I feel that Vietnam has become the great intellectual tragedy of our times. I'm not sure why this is. I'm still trying to determine why it is. Even today, my strongest feeling toward Vietnam remains puzzlement. I sort of stand in awe of people who are so dogmatic and tell me exactly what went right and what went wrong. I just can't see this. Maybe I know too much about it, maybe I don't know enough, but puzzlement remains my... So if you remain puzzled about the Vietnam War, I will not hold it against you. Another general observation on the problem of assessing the Vietnam War is temporal. It has to do with time. The Vietnam War went on for so long that assessments on it changed, rationales changed, opinions changed. The reason the war was being fought changed. There was two or three or maybe four wars back to back, and these simply cannot be analyzed as a single entity, as a single war. Another general observation or problem is that we live in an age of exaggeration. Television commercials, media hype, language of the young. Writers about Vietnam, fiction more than nonfiction, but I think this also extends to nonfiction, have this overriding characteristic about them of sheer hyperbolic exaggeration. It's made worse by a kind of parochialism or a narrowness of view. These writers know something about Vietnam, about the map of Vietnam, but they know very little about other wars, and other places, and other times. Vietnam, the novelists particularly, are always telling us that Vietnam was the most horrible war, the most atrocity-ridden war, the most bloody and destructive war, the roughest war of all times. The fact is that it was not. It was rough for some, but even then it was not the roughest. I would put anything experienced in Vietnam against the mind-destroying artillery fire of World War I, the use of phosgene poison gas that dissolves the tissues of your lungs, and you die of drowning in your own blood. I would put it up against Vietnam, against any of the savage island hopping of the South Pacific in World War II, the Normandy landing. Private Ryan's experience. Battle of the Bulge, the Chosun Reservoir retreat by the Marines in Korea. Vietnam had no monopoly on rough warfare, but the hyperbolic treatment of it permeates all the writings on Vietnam. And if those who do write serious books about Vietnam, it's because we lost the war, because we did not understand it, because we did not deserve to win, we did not try to win. All of these are simplistic explanations. So the historian's primary task is to answer the question, really, was the Vietnam War necessary? In these terms, it has validity, it has meaning, has relevance to actually what went on and what did not go on. But in this respect, we are still all prisoners of competing perceptions with respect to the Vietnam War. Finally, there is the further temporal judgment problem, which historians particularly have, and that is, looking back through history from our vantage point, it's clear that most of the wars fought had no significance for the future, did not really matter who won or lost. Anything past about 1500 AD, I see, comes in this. Consider Charlemagne's many wars and victories, the Hundred Years' War. Does it really matter to us today how this came out? It's not always true. There are some exceptions. The Battle of the Pass of Thermopylae, and the Greeks stopped the Turks. Great naval battle of Salamis, same thing. The Battle of Tours, Islam was turned back. Gettysburg. Some battles did make great sense. Whether Vietnam in its totality or any one of the single battles will ever be classified by this is really something only historians will, future historians will be able to do. We can't really do this now. We can't, we just don't have the ability to judge this thing in the, I've gone back and looked at the immediate reviews, assessments of the Civil War and the people in the Civil War that were produced, say, in the 1870s and 80s and 90s. And you can't believe some of the things that apparently intelligent, well-informed people were savaging of Lincoln, for example. The man was an utter fool. The man was a clown. He was an idiot. Never had a serious thought in his life, had no humanity, had no sense of feeling for people. He just made jokes about them. I don't see how anybody can see Lincoln that way. In retrospect, I don't think anybody does see him that way. But these were editorial writers, these were early political scientists or historians. And the moral of this is that we, you know, you mustn't be too dogmatic about any of the judgments now being made. All right, let's turn to this handout you have, the 17 reasons, most commonly encountered explanations for communist victory in Vietnam. Now, the first part of this I wrote in, I think the date is on here, well, I was at State Department, and the War College people, I think, this must have been about 3 months after the war was over, and they asked me to come up and lecture on why we lost the war in Vietnam or why we failed in Vietnam. And I didn't know what the answer to this was, but this was a very prestigious opportunity. These were all company field grade officers, and most of them have been in Vietnam. And so anyway, I went through the files and the holdings, and I singled out a total of, what was it, 18 of them? 17. explanation. Dr. Jenkins' office, please. No, I have a question. They called me earlier, and I don't want to get back to them on it. I want to talk to Dr. Jenkins' advice nurse, or Dr. Jenkins herself. How the fuck do you care what I'm doing? Hi, this is Douglas Pike at Texas Tech. I got a phone call this morning at home. I was gone about my Coumadin intake based on a blood test I went yesterday. And I don't know whether this came from Dr. Jenkins or from Dr. Basimi, who's the primary. Anyway, my wife wasn't too clear about how they want me to change this intake. This is Douglas Pike at Texas Tech. I got a phone call this morning about my Coumadin intake based on a blood sample I left yesterday, and I don't know whether this came from Dr. Jenkins or Dr. Basimi. Anyway, there was a suggestion that I change the amount of intake, and I want to talk to whoever it was that has that information. July 27th, 1924. But the call went to home, 796-3712. Right. Well, yeah, I'm taking five medicines, and they have changed this Coumadin intake over the months, and apparently they want to change it again, and it's not clear to what they want me to change it to. They said change your 5 milligrams to Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. I'm now taking 5 milligrams Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. That doesn't seem to make too much sense. But it may be that for a while we cut it in half. And my wife's speculation is that you think that I'm taking half a milligram, or half a pill, that's 2.5 milligrams, 7 days a week, except on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Instead of taking 2.5, I take 5. That seems pretty complicated to me, but the question is how much, the change they're ordering is not a change, that's the point. I mean, the total intake for the week is the same. So that does not seem logical that they would call me about that. So they must have something else in mind, or some other reason, or some other assumption. Can I talk to her now? I mean, you're the fourth person I've talked to and explained this, and I keep getting, you know, bounced around, and then I don't get an answer. I've got to go out now. I'm at the office, but I won't be home. And I presume you'll call home, and we'll have to go through the same drill.
Yeah. So have you any way of telling who called me? Was it Jenkins' office or Basinski? It was Jenkins' office. Huh? It's which office called me, but yeah, okay, well that's the main thing, and if there's nobody I can talk to now, I guess I'll have to call back. Thank you. Huh? Huh? All right.
About whom? The meaning is that God helps those who help themselves, that He will only help those who help themselves, and He cannot help those who cannot help themselves. I have a feeling that this is applicable in the Mideast today, between the Arabs and the Jews. We can't do it. God can maybe do it, but they've got to want to do it. But if they can't do it, then he cannot help them. Another conclusion that was stronger at the end of the war, I think, was that aggression will pay only if you can manage to make it into a protracted conflict. You have to draw things out in time. You can introduce great obfuscation, which permits manipulation of external perception. Aggression becomes liberation. Peace is worth any price. The rhetoric coming out of the Mideast fits this absolutely on both sides or on all sides. There is aggressive action on both sides, but it's protracted and you don't see it as aggression particularly. I used to believe, and I think a lot of my fellow political scientists believe, that a democracy cannot fight a protracted conflict. A variant of that was that no society can, no matter how totalitarian it is, can fight a protracted conflict. That there was no known proven counter-strategy for the 50-year war thesis. It might be there, but it's not known and proven yet. And inevitably, under this concept, there will develop the idea that the war itself is the chief destructive force, and it's going to destroy everything in front of it, including all the important virtues, such as values, and values such as loyalty, honor, integrity. I used to think that was true of the British in Ireland, and now sort of magically this is hasn't disappeared, but it is as a destructive force. It's not there as it once was. Again, I'm not sure why this is, but maybe it's just this characteristic of people's habit of, as my old debate coach, this tendency to deviate into truth, which you can't really explain. Well, we should always keep in mind the dualism of the Vietnam War. It existed on two levels, one military and one political. Such was its nature. Communists understood this better than we. Their strategy rested on the concept of Dao Chan, of struggle, armed struggle, political struggle, diplomatic struggle, if you will. We didn't really understand the nature of the war as the other side perceived it. Probably that one of the primary reasons that it turned out the way it did. It was a different kind of war. If we lost the battles, we would lose the war. But if we won the battles, we didn't necessarily win the war. The American military actually did everything that was expected of it and more. It was a system that we were up against. Part of failure to understand the other side, which isn't a very understandable human failure. So, let me give you a few tentative judgments, conclusions. One, the Vietnam War was unique and singular. It was new both in degree and kind. It is the new face of war of the future. It went on in one place, in Vietnam, and also throughout the world. All wars are parochial, as the Vietnam War was. Even world wars are limited physically and in terms of respective national interests. No one thinks of himself as fighting a world war. Only a war here on Normandy Beach, or at Stalingrad, or the Coral Sea. Important point is to recognize that this localitis is not the meaning of the war, that you cannot regard the war on a broad canvas, cannot apply to it more meaning than it deserves. The second judgment, or this is a kind of tentative conclusion, is the thesis that we snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. This is an important interpretation on the outcome of the war. It's an assessment of why it turned out the way it did. It might be called the great paradox interpretation. It argues that the communists were actually defeated, and then, having been defeated, we permitted them to win. This had nothing to do with the war itself, but was attributable to domestic politics in the United States and in Saigon among the Vietnamese. The chain of logic in this is that the objective of the Politburo from the war from the start was unification of North and South Vietnam under its banner. It saw various ways that this could be accomplished, but soon devolved into a doctrinal argument between hardliners, let's do it militarily on the ground in the South, and the so-called softliners, and so-called doves, who do it through a mix of warfare, politics with guns, diplomacy. This was the hawk-dove argument. The hardliners, or the hawks, controlled the decision-making from the start, but they were unable to deliver victory. And it switched then into this hawk-dove dispute, where the two protagonists at the Politburo had their time at bat. They could have a chance to do what they wanted to do, their strategy. The war was seen by all in the Politburo as stalemate, finally by 1973. Recognition that unification had to be pursued by some other means than simply on the battlefield. That is, by armed Dao Chan. That was not enough. That's the meaning of the Paris Agreements, and that's why Hanoi signed them. It continued maintenance of this policy, however, turned on the credibility of American enforcement of the agreements, and the softliner argument that if the agreements are broken, the B-52s will come back with a vengeance. When it became apparent, because of the Watergate debacle, that an impotent American president would be unable to send back the B-52s, the hardliners were able to get Politburo approval for one last hurrah to achieve unification. Authorization, according to this thesis, authorization would never have been granted had American credibility, military credibility, been maintained. There would never have been a last hurrah. The victory originally won would have been sustained. That is, defeat was seized from the jaws of victory. Kissinger is a major exponent of this. He sets forth his position very clearly and forcefully. Also, William Colby, the former CIA director, in his book Lost Victory. I'll make a variant argument on this jaws defeat from the jaws of victory next time. Based on some research that we did at Cal and a book that we're supposed to write on it, but probably never will. The third is a socio-psychological thesis. It holds that the strategy used by Hanoi, political armed Dao Chan, forces us to evaluate the war in equivalent terms, as we've got to look at it in terms of social dynamics, social psychology. The essential reason, the central reason, the single most important reason why the Vietnam War ended the way it did, according to this thesis, lies within the Vietnamese psyche. It lies with the Americans, with the Vietnamese, not with the Americans and not with the other allies. It can be found, and historians will eventually find it, by exploring the socio-psychology of Vietnam on both sides, North and South. In a certain way, this is a kind of commonplace interpretation. It has to do with a test of willpower and determination, and these are largely psychological in nature. And all wars are a test of willpower and determination. So having said that, you haven't said very much. It has to do with esprit de corps, with spirit in general. But what we're talking about here is something different than simply esprit de corps. It has to do with uncertainty and a sense of self-confidence. It's not based on objective evaluation, but it's a cultural and historical thing. How sure are people? How confident are people? Americans in their past wars were extraordinarily confident. They lost much of that confidence, probably as beginning with the Korean War. I mean, it really came to fruition in the case of the Vietnam War. But contemporary writings of the Americans going to France in World War I. I mean, they were so sure they were going to win the war. It's going to be over when we get there. And it was. And so all of this confidence was simply verified. Nobody ever questioned it. Not a questioning of the war, but our ability to fight it was never even examined. And it was a little puzzling why the Europeans, that is the French and the German and the British particularly, were unable to do this. And we weren't really that superior, but nobody bothered to point this out to us, I guess. So what was present in the Vietnam War in the North was determination. You can argue about how this came about, how it was mobilized, what motivational methods were used. But the fact of the determination of the system is unarguable. What was lacking in the South, which proved to be the fatal flaw, was self-confidence. This lack in turn was a product of a long and complex Vietnamese sense of relationships and foreigners we talked about in an early lecture, Doc Lop, independence. Independence does not mean simply, though, a spirit of independence like the American Revolution. It also involves a complex set of binding ties. It's not simply a profound sense of self-determination. The South Vietnamese, all Vietnamese, I think, culturally, leader and follower alike, don't believe that they could, well, at the individual level, the Vietnamese doesn't really believe that he can make it through life by himself. And they reject this whole notion of independence, of American spirit of self-confidence, and I don't need anybody that, the pioneer who, you know, who was absolutely independent of everyone. They reject that really in part as being unnecessary, if not ridiculous. But beyond that, they believe that you can't make it through life without establishing these connections outside of the family and the clan, in which there's a mutual responsibility. It's not friendship. It's a little like the American concept of you have your own dentist, your own mechanic, your own serviceman of various types, yard man, and so on. And you need these. And you do things for him, he does things for you, and it's the way a Confucian system runs. Well, in the case of the Vietnamese communists, I think it was very strong in their mind that they couldn't make it without help, outside help from their allies. They kept saying they didn't need outside help. That's what you do, he says. You don't portray yourself as being dependent. South Vietnamese did the same thing. Both or all Vietnamese seem to have a psychic need for and also a fear of an alliance. That's the Duc Lap syndrome. It's not found in other societies. In Hanoi, it was seen as by the leadership as an endemic weakness in Vietnamese character. Constantly, Ho Chi Minh constantly railed against it. The agitprop cadres lectured on Kin Tao, self-criticism sessions. It was a kind of schizoid attitude, both personal and social. Every Vietnamese knows his country's history is intimately bound up with his neighbors, chiefly the Chinese, but that's a history of betrayal, duplicity, and defeat. There's a kind of umbilical cord that something that connects Vietnamese to political movements. Every major political movement in this century, in North and South Vietnam, had this sort of psychic connection. The Vietnam Quoc Son Dang with China, Dai Viet with Japan, early reformers in the South with the French left, Ngo Dinh Diem, and those who came later with the U.S., the Buddhists and the militant Buddhists around Asia, particularly Sri Lanka, and the Viet Minh, with their Hanoi leaders, with the three brands of communism. All of these had this umbilical cord, and they could not, it was just a sense of this, and that if anything happened to that, it would have deleterious effects on their movement and their cause. Other revolutionaries, Nehru in India, and the Dutch and Indonesians, and had connections with the motherland, with revolutionary supporters there. But still the sense was that they had to make it on their own, they had to work it on their own. And the American leaders and Americans in Vietnam were constantly assuring the Vietnamese of our determination to stand with them. Even if American troops were withdrawn, we said, as a domestic political necessity, moral support would continue, military support would, as would military and other American aid. In actuality, I think, in objective terms, the South Vietnamese, at the end, were able to stand alone. They should have been able to withstand the North Vietnamese military assault when it came in 1975, but they did not believe that they could. And because of this, when the test came, they could not. One cannot do what one thinks one cannot do. This came to me in a blinding flash of insight when I was back in Washington about a month or two after the end of the Vietnam War. My son Andrew had gotten a new bicycle, and we had this house in Cleveland Park, and there's this alley out behind the house, and he was out there on this bicycle, and he got on and he fell off. I stood in the window watching. He got on again and he fell off. I'd said to him, "I'll help you." No, I can do it myself. Well, after about four tries, he came back in and said, "I wonder if you could help me just a little bit." I said, "Sure, what do you want?" "Well, could you hold the seat?" And we call it a saddle. "All right, would you hold the saddle, and we'll go down the alley and come back and go down and back, and you hang on to it so it doesn't fall over." I said, "Okay." So I run down the alley, we turn around and come back. I run down the alley, come back. And of course, you know, on a bicycle, once you get the momentum up, it'll run by itself practically. You don't have to. So about the third trip, I took my hand off the saddle. It was near it, but I could reach it. But I got all the way down, halfway back, hadn't touched the saddle. He looks around, he sees that I'm not holding the saddle, and he falls over. He did not think he could ride that bike unless I was holding onto it. And I tried to reason with him. I wasn't holding it. He went down and back. "No, I can't do it unless you hang on." So we did it a number of more times. I finally convinced him that he really could. It was a matter of mechanics or Gresham or somebody, Newton's law or something, about Objects in motion tend to remain in motion. Annie finally now has a Honda, huge Honda motorcycle, biggest they make. It's coming down here from San Francisco. He's a chef in Paris, of all places, but he just came back to the U.S. Now he's coming down on the motorcycle to cook Thanksgiving dinner. And we'll have a great argument because the chef he learned how to roast turkey taught him that you cut the turkey up and you roast it, then you take it out and you put it back together and serve it. And I say this is ridiculous. We've never done it that way in this country. Pilgrims didn't do it that way. That's good enough for us. He's a pretty good cook. Anyway, let me just summarize the conclusions of the first half of this. The other side will come next week. It's the other coin of the assessment. That is the U.S. measure. What are we to take of the Americans back in Washington? Anyway, these are 5 points, I think, that summarize the basic conclusions that I would come to about the Vietnam War. First, and this is repeating what I've said to some degree, it was a singular war, new in history. It was made so by technology and politics. Since everything connected with it is of necessity to some extent, the assessment made must flow from this fact of the similarity. What you're measuring here is technology and its contributions, which is the helicopter, politics, and the whole notion of political struggle. Two, the final outcome was ambiguous in terms of proffered explanation. Usually in assessing a war, if the course, beginning, middle, and end, become clear in retrospect. This has not happened in the case of the Vietnam War, at least not yet. Was their clear-cut victory in Hanoi, or did they really win, hands down, no question, or was it a case of defeat snatched out of the jaws of victory by the South Vietnamese and their allied forces? Three, central explanation of the course and the final outcome of the war lies primarily with the Vietnamese psyche, the personality, the ethos. It has to do with socio-psychological dynamics of the Vietnamese on both sides, all sides. Saigon Vietnamese, the Viet Cong Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, the Sino-Vietnamese, and so on. Four, the Allied forces, and the South Vietnamese in particular, suffered from what Aldous Huxley has called invincible ignorance. Something you don't know you don't know it, you don't think it makes any difference. And in most cases it doesn't, but in some cases it does, and this is the case where it did. The roots of this invincible ignorance was poor strategic thinking, particularly in Vietnam. I would say it was also poor strategic thinking in the case of the North Vietnamese, even though they did win. When you go to Hanoi today and you ask North Vietnamese military, particularly the younger ones in the military, I've had sessions with them, you say, how do you feel about the Vietnam War? It was just. It was proper, yes. It was well worth fighting, well worth winning. Oh, absolutely. It was a holy crusade. It was a cause that is as strong and as powerful as it ever was. No objection, no doubts about, no, none of them. How about the way that you won the war? How about that? That's another matter. we could have done it better and faster and sooner and easier. And I say, how? Well, we haven't really worked that out. But here at the school, this is what we're working on. We think that there are there were methods and strategies and tactics that would have worked much better. And that's what we're trying to figure out. This is really historical revisionism. It's the beginning of it. You say, what do you think of General Chop? Well, yes, he's a great man and so on. But we're not too sure that he was, you know, we don't say anything against him, but maybe he should have thought of some things that we can now think of. I mean, maybe nobody could have thought of them then. But I mean, it's not a betting of their history, but it's the start of historical revisionism, exactly what started in West Point at the end of the war, and in the war colleges. Very serious attention to what went wrong. Of course, the Americans are much more candid on this, and they don't mind dumping on Westmoreland or others, particularly the Marines, who are the most candid of all, I'd say, for some good reason. Anyway, I guess the final thought is much of what I say on the assessment of the war about the South Vietnamese, which I'm talking about mostly here, as opposed to the Americans next time, to a large degree also applies in a somewhat different way to the North Vietnamese. That's the most interesting part of the Vietnam War, in my opinion, and if any of you in here who are going on in history and want to deal with that aspect, how do the North Vietnamese, how do the Vietnamese in Hanoi, people, how do they see the war today in objective terms, not propaganda terms? You have to go there to do this. You have to establish contacts, but we could help you do this at our center. We've got good connections. It's very time-consuming, and I'm not sure to what end it would be. It might earn you a PhD thesis. Okay, well, that's it. Happy Thanksgiving. See you next week. Well, do you have any questions about this? Anything, any doubts, anything that isn't? Any giggles? No, nary a giggle even. No. Oh, thank you.
Planning to give us a take-on
card? Well, I'm not sure what the rules on this are. Did you read this?
No, I didn't read that.
Well, you should have. It has to do with the final exam. Do we have any seniors in here who know all about final exams? Well, what are the rules? And did you people read this?
That just means like someone your final exam.
Yeah, I thought I understand how you can't give it in advance to one person, but this take home, as I read it, that...
You turn it back at the time you get your final. You can't turn it back.
Well, the final exam is on a certain place at a certain time,
well,
a certain day,
unless
right?
You do a take home.
Now, what you... All right, then you get that in advance of this and bring it in on that hour and a half?
You can bring it back before, or you can bring it back at that time, but no later than that.
Yeah, I'm
just trying to think
it works. It must be brought back. It's like if you sit. Actually, I guess you could come in here and sit and write if you want.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But if you'd rather.
Yeah.
As most people would rather.
I don't think anybody's going to take it.
Right. Well, I guess I have to be here, though.
Well, if you don't have to be here.
We can just take it to you wherever you are.
Well, I'm not you sure about that.
If you're
yeah,
a candidate.
My professor does it. He says bring it to his office.
We did it just last semester.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take on the test, and it was just due by 12. It was our final was scheduled from 1:30 to 4,
yeah.
Like on a Tuesday, and it was the paper you had to hand it in by 4 o'clock on
right.
Tuesday.
Right.
And you can bring it to their office.
And you can bring it to their office as well.
Right. But not a minute later.
No, not after that.
Exactly. Okay.
At 4 o'clock, it's late and you don't get graded.
All right. Well.
And the graduating seniors get theirs graded first.
What's your name?
Andrew.
I'll tell Gary Bell. Andrew, explain this to me. Andrew, I can remember. My son's name.
Oh, that's true.
Well, my phone number.
Do you have our midterms from last?
Oh dear, no, I was meant to bring them in, but I didn't. I'll bring them in.
I didn't get the sentence.
You didn't?
Well, I wouldn't bother, you should show up on time.
Excuse me, I'm here 2 minutes too. We're just fighting.
Okay, anybody else not playing with?
I'm not paying customers for that.
Another thing about the pay card, you like, I'm a graduating senior, so you have to grade mine first. Because you like, you submit the graduating.
I'll grade them all the same day that the, I'll grade them the afternoon of the.
I know, that's what my other professors say, they just ask for graduating.
Yeah, I know, but no, I'm very prompt about that sort of thing. It's a monkey, I wanna get off my back. It's funny. Yeah.
Can I write a paper on the search and destroy tactic?
Yeah. I don't know much about it, but.
Can you give me much on it?
Well, it was one of Westmoreland's ideas. I don't think that Abrams thought much of it. I mean, they tended to get off that tactic. But at the time he explained it, the war has moved on. It was a good idea then, but not now, which is what he would say about his previous, his predecessor anyway. We've got stuff on this at the archive, the diagrams and schematics of what.
You mean
I'm not, yeah, what you have to do is identify it as an intellectual concept or a military concept. And I'm not a military analyst, but almost anybody should come in and talk to Jim Rector. Ask him, he's in our office.
Do you happen to know when the Southwest Collections thing is open, this next week? Or this week, I mean. Is it closed the rest of the week?
It was closed this morning when I went in at 10:30, and they were supposed to have a press conference on some artwork that was from Hanoi that was donated. I got a guy to open the door for me. Went in and looked at it, but they've run a kind of strange ship over there, but I mean, they never seem to be there to answer the phone. They always have enough, but they get back to you very quickly, and so at least get back to me very quickly.
Would there be any books anywhere but the archives? I mean, that's, I can't take anything out from there. Yeah.
Well, there's, among the books we have over there are these TMs and FMs, the technical manuals, field manuals, published by the Army. And in those there will be a complete description of the search and destroy, if you get the right date. I mean, it has to be one that was published, they published them about every 2 years. And I suppose when Abrams came along, they took that out and put some
of that. What year would that be? What year for?
Well, it would be 65 to 67, 68, 70 maybe.
You got RMs or what are they called?
Huh?
What were they called? TMs?
TM, technical manual. Or okay. Field manual. That field manual is the lower level. You got a car?
Yeah.
Well, we're having a Vietnam board meeting today at 3:30 at the ICC.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of veterans there. And if you come over a little in advance, I will try to find one that can maybe help you on this. I'm not a military analyst.
I'm taking two people home at 3:30, so they can't be there.
What technical manual are you looking for?
A search and destroy mission. Now what is a search and destroy as a tactic or a strategy?
I'm not sure that was ever really codified in.
Maybe not.
Daniel, they got my old Army OCS name. I could probably bring
I know that Westmoreland pushed it in a very big way. Yeah. I'm sure there's stuff. I know there's stuff written.
It was never really in a technical manual as such.
Well,
if you check the tech library documents, I mean, that's basically you've got the name and collection of the technical
manual there. That's a fairly tough subject. You're not ROTC or anything like that. Well, why would you want to?
Just because it's objective and it's like, it would be too intellectual.
It's too intellectual?
No, it would not be too intellectual.
Well, somebody would say that's all it was. It was an intellectual idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's what you're in college for, to make up these decisions and make decisions and decisions.
All right.
Let's start at the archive. I knew they do have materials on this, but whether they can find them for you, whether you can find them over there.
Was there any other kind of strategy that would be easier to do later on than you had in the surgery show?
Well, Westmoreland had a series of, you know, fire bases, for example, where you can fire at everything. The long-range patrols to go in around the enemy. These are all tactics, really, or methods, defensive methods of how to make a strategic village strategic, how to defend itself against the enemies, the technology of it.